Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today I'll be interviewing Professor Afretin, Professor of Law in the Kirkland and Ellis Corporate Lab at the University of Chicago Law School. You also hold a BA in English and Philosophy from Emory University and a JD from the University of Chicago Law School. My name is Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. To start off with, could you tell me a little bit about what you did before your role as a clinical professor at the law school, and what you did to get to this point, and what your research interests are?
Yeah, and thank you for having me, Ken, and thank you for the introduction. It's great to be here with you today. So, as you mentioned, I'm a clinical professor at University of Chicago in the Kirkland & Ellis Corporate Lab, which is one of our transactional law clinics. Prior to that, as you mentioned, I went to Emory University, where I majored in English and Philosophy, and then University of Chicago Law School, where I graduated in 2012, which is crazy how quickly it goes by. When I was a student, I was actually in this clinic. I was one of the first, I think, two classes that had this clinic offered to us. I liked it so much, I made my way back eventually. But in the interim, I did debt finance at both Sidley Austin here in Chicago and Goodwin Procter in Boston. And I served as corporate counsel doing securities and M&A work at Groupon here in Chicago.
And you're also a professor at among the best and most prestigious law school in the world, the University of Chicago Law School. And as you just mentioned, you've dealt with litigation and in corporate counsel to companies like Groupon Inc. While you were serving as corporate counsel to Groupon Inc., what were your some of your primary responsibilities?
Yeah, so at Groupon, I did securities and M&A work. We had a unique group where we had a small number of lawyers who were dedicated both to securities and M&A. During, half the year, I worked on mostly, 8K, 10K, 10Q, proxy statement, that sort of stuff. And then I would shift focus to doing merger and acquisitions as they popped up. Throughout my time there, we did probably somewhere between 7 and 10 acquisitions and one divestiture. And we also entered into a revolving credit facility. So it was a lot of fun both learning new things and still getting to work in some capacity as a debt lawyer when we entered into the credit facility.
Could you explain a little bit about what debt lawyering is, what that term exactly means?
Yeah, certainly. So as a debt lawyer, well, I should take a step back. When a company is looking for financing, they generally have two options, right? They can enter into a debt financing transaction or agreement, or they could get equity financing. The difference being with the debt financing arrangement, I, as the company, am incurring debt. You, it's Ken, the bank, are lending me money that you expect to pay back, me to pay back with interest over a certain time period. Now, there's different flavors of how these transactions might work, but straightforward, you're the bank lending me the money. I pay back at 4% interest or something like that. Whereas an equity financing transaction is I, the company, take money from you, and in exchange, I give you a portion of my company, an equity ownership. So I did debt, and what my debt transactions looked like at Sidley were typically securitization facilities where companies would pool huge assets or huge tranches of assets, usually receivables of some sort, and they would borrow against those. And when I was at Goodwin, I did a lot of just plain vanilla credit agreements, like I just discussed, and also some private equity transactions where it's also known as leverage finance, where a company borrows money to acquire another company.
And while you were working as a corporate lawyer, what sort of corporate laws and regulations did you look at? Did you look at, policymakers from the public sector, or did you just look at laws, or what sort of things did you look at while you were a corporate
Yeah,
lawyer?
so from that perspective, I'll answer based on my time at Groupon, where I was handling, along with a couple other lawyers on the team, all of our SEC filings. So the Securities and Exchange Commission requires publicly traded companies to file publicly available statements on the occurrence of certain events, and also one each quarter, and then it's called 10Q, and a bigger filing called 10K annually.
My next question for you is, Professor, what is the difference between private practice and in-house practice?
Yeah, so there are a few differences, and this is a question I get from students a lot, especially students who are, you know, thinking about going in-house eventually. They want to know about, you know, career trajectory or just what the difference between the two is. Private practice, obviously, you are doing a lot more one-off transactions with clients. Your clients come to you when they have a specific need. You see them through, in my case, you know, a debt financing. It would be a 3 to 6 month cycle or something like that. And then, you know, they go on, assuming the credit agreement is executed well, they go on, they don't have any issues, and you don't really necessarily see them again until they need to enter into another credit agreement or something like that. In-house is a little different in that you're, you know, embedded within your client. Your client is the company that you're working for, and you're also dealing with a lot more non-legal folks, right? So whereas in private practice, I every day was sitting with, you know, hundreds of other lawyers in big offices. When I was in-house, I was sitting with a dozen other lawyers in an office full of 1,000 people, most of whom were not lawyers. The questions that you might be asked are a little different. Typically, when you're at a big law firm, you have very sophisticated clients who are, you know, paying a lot of money for your time. So they ask you very pointed questions, and you are answering or doing very specific things. When you're in-house, your clients sometimes don't know what they don't know. And it's up to you to sort of guide them through the process of, one, figuring out what their legal need is, and then seeing it through from start to finish. Sometimes that might involve bringing in outside counsel for all or a portion of the process, but not necessarily always. When, for example, at Groupon, we did probably 75% of the transactions that I worked on, we did fully in-house, where we had a small legal team. I worked with the business development team, and, you know, we just hammered it out just with Groupon lawyers. These were typically, you know, $3 to $10 million transactions. There wasn't a lot of room to get, you know, to get approval for outside funding or for outside counsel. So one of the highlights to me of my in-house experience was when I got to, you know, work on Groupon's credit agreement that they entered into, and I was working with a lot of non-lawyers, and I found that I had this passion for sort of translating legal terms and legalese, as people call it, into a format that's more easily digestible for non-lawyers. So this meant, you know, walking through our accounting teams or business development teams or on you know, what certain clauses meant and what different targets we had to hit or metrics that we had to avoid.
Question for you is, Professor, could you talk a little bit about what advice you had for first year law school students? Because you went to the University of Chicago Law School yourself, so you were in the shoes of a lot of first years and incoming students.
Yeah, so one thing that I would advise, you know, first year students is to not necessarily be so certain about what practice area they want to go into. I often have students who, you know, come into the lab and say, I definitely want to go into M&A, or I definitely want to go into tax, or some people who don't take the lab because they say, I definitely want to go into litigation. But, you know, if you don't have broad exposure to other practice areas, you might not know, you know, that there's something out there that you like, or that there's something out there that you specifically don't like. And it's important to get a flavor for a bunch of things before you embark on, you know, a 30, 40 year career doing something that you might not like. So I encourage everyone to take a wide variety of classes from a wide variety of professors, to the extent that there are clinics that you can take, try to get exposure to different types of clients and different practices of law, because at the end of the day, you know, this is the time to experiment and to think about, or to challenge yourself and even challenge your preconceptions.
And Professor Averton, what sort of contracts did you work on while you were at these corporate firms?
When I was in private practice, I worked mostly with credit agreements as the primary deal documents. A credit agreement in a commercial setting is similar to what you might expect with a credit agreement in, you know, a personal setting if you're, you know, taking on financing to buy a car or something like that, except it's on a much grander scale. So we would do, you know, several hundred million to low $1-2 billion facilities. And the credit agreement is the primary deal document. The credit agreement is the contract between, in the case of the deals I was working on, a bank and the borrower, who could either be a private equity firm or a company, and in rare cases, you know, a high net worth individual. And the credit agreement basically just details all of the specifics of the loan. It includes things like what you can and cannot use the loan proceeds for. whether you as the company have to maintain a certain debt to income ratio, whether you as the company can seek lending from other sources, stuff like that. It also contains repayment schedules and things that might trigger an advanced repayment of the loan.
Great. That sounds like really interesting work. And I want to move on to what you mentioned earlier about what you worked on as a student at the law school and eventually what you're leading now, which is the Kirkland and Ellis Corporate Lab. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what it is and what your role is?
Yeah. So in the Kirkland Ellis Corporate Lab, we work with about 40 to 50 Fortune 500 companies. We interface directly with their legal departments. My colleague David Zarkis and I run the lab, and it's about 50 students a quarter at the university. We split these students into teams. Each team is assigned to several companies, and you know, we have weekly calls with each client where their legal departments kind of ask our students to just, you know, work on whatever they need done. One of the few parameters we give our clients is that it has to be real work they're assigning, and that they don't have to make anything up just for the benefit of our students. This means that our students are always working on, you know, hot button legal issues, and it's always something that our clients are, one, grateful to have, because how can you turn down free legal work? And two, it gives our students a very good opportunity to work, you know, in a fast-paced environment similar to what they might be doing in a law firm when they graduate.
Yeah, it sounds like a great opportunity for students. And I also want to ask, what do students at the law school do outside of the classroom in the Kirkland and Alice Corporate Lab?
Yeah, so when we're in the in-class sessions, we use to either lecture on, you know, niche practice areas or topics that we see coming up a lot in client assignments, right? So it's been, over the past year, there's been a lot about remote work policies. 2 years ago, there's a lot about the GDPR, which is the EU's data privacy law. And that's what we use our in-class time for. When we have class meetings outside of class, it typically revolves around one of two things. One, we have calls with our clients where we're having intake calls or going over assignments that we've already done. Or two, we try to get our students used to, you know, networking and doing client interaction that they might not get a chance to do until, you know, several years down the line at a law firm. So we try to have either dinner or lunch or, you know, a cocktail with local clients to, you know, to put a face to the name and get our students to meet people and practice their networking skills.
And at some of these events, I've heard that there are experienced practitioners, business leaders, and other esteemed guests to discuss topics and business and law issues. From your perspective, Professor, what were some of your favorite or most memorable guests that have shown up to these events?
Yeah, so you're 100% right. We do have, we call it our speaker series. And the initial impetus behind this was sort of, what do I wish I learned in law school that I didn't get a chance to learn before going into practice? We also wanted to expand that to inviting speakers that might be in more, you know, niche practice areas that you don't get a chance to get some exposure to in law school, like compliance or employment, labor, immigration, stuff like that. From my perspective, the most interesting clients always tend to be the ones who frankly have some colorful stories from the course of their careers. And, you know, that often means M&A lawyers who have been on, you know, very contentious deals, or it might mean people at high profile companies such as the National Basketball Association who have come in to give some talks.
Well, that's amazing to hear that all of these great guests get to come through the Kirkland and Ellis Lab. And my question to you is, following the completion of the academic year, what is the lab host and what is the lab convene for in terms of conferences and symposiums?
Yeah, so throughout the school year, we typically work on preparing a conference for the upcoming year. The past couple of years, we haven't had one, obviously, because of the pandemic. We're trying to think of what might make a good conference for the fall. So we're not quite sure what we're going to be hosting next year, but typically we host a conference and we invite practitioners from around the country, both legal, a combination of legal scholars, in-house practitioners, and people in private practice. the last conference we held, I believe it was 3 years ago now, was on automation and outsourcing and sort of the role that AI and legal tech is going to have in either augmenting or replacing various legal functions in outsourcing agreements. And in addition to that, throughout the summer, we have In addition to that, throughout the summer, we host a transactional challenge. David, my colleague, and I realized a few years back that, you know, law review is obviously great and it's more tailored to people who are into legal or interested in legal research and writing. It has kind of a litigation slant or policy slant. We wanted to have some sort of a contest similar to the law review write-on that would serve as an analog for transactional lawyers. So we have this transactional challenge every summer where we put together anywhere between 3 to 5 exercises, and they're typically, you know, marking up some sort of a contract, doing brief research based on, you know, a prompt that a general counsel might write about, you know, an issue that company's facing, and so on. And we grade those, and the winners get a chance to, you know, go to a dinner with some Kirkland attorneys, and everyone who participates gets to go to a cocktail hour and, you know, network and mingle.
That sounds like a great opportunity for students to be able to network and even have great dinner. And my next question to you is, what kind of students does the Kirkland and Ellis Corporate Lab attract?
So I like to say that we attract the best and brightest at the law school. I don't know how true that necessarily is. It might be a bias that I have, but, you know, all of our students, everyone at the law school is extraordinarily talented and eager to learn. And that's something that, you know, keeps the job exciting and keeps me really interested in going in every day. We try to give as much of a transactional bent, obviously, that's the name of the clinic, to the projects that we take on. But we have taken on, you know, some litigation assignments as well on either student requests, students who either want to rule out litigation or have an interest in litigation in addition to transactional work, or our clients sometimes need help with a litigation focused memo. You know, that's the minority of the work. Typically we do attract students who are interested in contract drafting or other transactional matters. So we try to seek out students who are interested in that and work that suits their interests.
Well, that's really amazing about the opportunities that students could potentially have. My next question is, could you tell me a little bit about your instructional style at the corporate lab and how you've incorporated that into the Kirkland and Ellis corporate lab clinic?
Yeah, I guess I would describe my instructional style as ad hoc. We try to keep everything topical, right? So most of our lesson plans revolve just around what our students are working on at the time. We also like to the extent that students have projects that are presented in forms other than memos or contracts, like often we have training modules that we'll put together, for example, for FCPA training for companies that we've presented to their sales force, or we have questions that actually board of directors want to review, and, you know, boards typically want PowerPoints easily digestible because they don't have a lot of time. So for those sorts of projects, we do a dry run. We use our class sessions as a dry run where I serve as, you know, either the general counsel or the audience, and I, you know, interrupt with questions to try to keep the students on their toes and get them used to presenting in front of a group. And it gives the students or an audience, you know, an experience in just seeing what that's like as well. Also, we'll use the class sessions where students have marked up a contract to go over, you know, contract drafting skills, where I might do my own markup of the contract that the client sent around. And I will, you know, superimpose one against the other on the screen, and then we'll go over what our students did. And I'll just offer tips and tricks based on, you know, what I did versus what they did versus how the company originally had it. And I'll just provide any insight I can that way.
How do you think this clinic prepares students for careers if they want to go into public service?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think that the word transactional in the clinic title might sometimes deter students who are interested in public service from, you know, going to the clinic. But I think there are a lot of skills that are transferable no matter what sort of career you anticipate going into. The ability to work with a client, the ability to communicate in a clear and concise method, the ability to meet deadlines. There's a lot of soft skills that you're going to learn through client interaction and working in a real world setting that you won't get otherwise in law school. And, you know, it's the case whether you're working with a large corporation or for a public interest client. And I think that we set students up for success regardless of what they plan on going to.
Well, that's all the time that we have left for this interview. And thank you again for having this wonderful conversation, Professor. And before we end the interview, do you have any lasting words for you know, our audience who are mostly out in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, if any students have any questions or interests or feel that they would like to, you know, to chat, feel free to, I don't know if you're posting my profile on the website or whatever, but, you know, feel free to reach out. And one piece of advice I like to give to all law students, regardless of where they are, is to really take advantage of everything that the law school offers you. I know that there's a tendency, and I certainly had this tendency when I was a law student, you know, after 1 year, after I had my full-time offer locked up, to spend more time with extracurricular activities, which is all well and good, but, you know, the law school opens a lot of doors for you, and it's really up to you to make the most of what it offers. Whether that's, you know, networking events that they hold or just getting to know your professors really well, there's, you know, a wealth of experience and knowledge that you're fortunate enough to have access to, and it's really behooves you to tap into that.
Well, thank you again for having this wonderful conversation. And thank you everyone in this for listening to the episode of The Robots Are Coming. Next time we'll have even more professors speaking on the topics of public policy, entrepreneurship, and more clinics at the law school. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all your buddies to do that as well. Thank you so much, Professor.
Sure, thank you.